For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to make two kind of disclaimers, apologies, sort of in advance. The first one being that, as Tygon mentioned, we are in the middle of our practice period, so we're discussing the 10 paramitas, the virtues of a bodhisattva, and I will be speaking about one of those. And my comments are largely sort of framed with the people who've been participating in the practice commitment period in mind. And so if it sort of gets a little confusing, please just bear, for the rest of you, just bear with me, and there'll be questions afterwards. The second sort of disclaimer is that because I confuse myself very often, I'm going to stick pretty closely to my notes here. Otherwise, I'm almost certain I'll get lost on this one, and I may anyway. So, thank you for your patience, which, by the way, is the second of our paramitas. The one I'm going to talk about is Shila, Sanskrit word Shila, which we often translate as ethical conduct or ethical discipline. And I really want to talk about this in the broadest possible terms that I can, the most general way, rather than looking at, you know, sort of ins and outs of particular precepts or examining which particular actions might agree with this or that precept or violate this or that precept, but to talk about it in really general terms. And the most general thing I can say about it, in my understanding, is that we should understand Shila, ethical conduct, as practice, or to use Dogen's term, the practice realization of non-separation. And I'm really struck by the fact that this, of course, could just as well be a description of Zazen. And this is really suggestive to me because it suggests that Zazen and Shila are themselves possibly not separate. You know, and this isn't the main point of non-separation that I want to talk about, but it's an important one, so I want to touch on it up front. You know, Dogen, for example, in Fukan Zazengi, a very famous short piece, characterizes Zazen as, quote, the Dharma gate of joyful ease. At the same time, the core meanings of the word Shila in the Sanskrit and the Pali, apparently, I get this from Robert Aitken Roshi, mean cool and peaceful. So at the very least, the central meanings sort of dramatically overlap. And I think this is an interesting thing to keep in mind. The entirety of the Buddhist tradition, you know, because of how we come to Buddhist practice in the West, we usually get an interest in meditation, and we get involved in Zazen practice, and then gradually we start hearing about these things called the precepts, and we might sew a robe or a rakusu, you know, and then there's this other quality, prajna, that we don't talk about so much, but it's always around. You know, but because of that sort of situation, we tend to think of meditation practice and the practice of precepts somewhat separately. But the tradition, from the very beginning, all aspects of the tradition sort of warn against doing this. There's this really wonderful word in Pali, which I discovered, which I'm going to have to try here. Silapatana paramasa. What silapatana paramasa refers to is, quote, the foolish fondling of precepts and practices. In other words, you know, getting a little bit too wrapped up in sort of the doctrinal things and certain practices, and sort of setting aside meditation. And this, of course, is, you know, refers to exactly what Zen as a separate tradition, at least in part, arose as a kind of reaction to, a remedy for. In the Platform Sutra, Wei Nung, the sixth ancestor, says that without Shila, without the precepts, without ethical conduct, samadhi, meditation, and prajna, wisdom, are useless, pretty strong. Dogen, in his fascicle Jukai, by the way, for those who don't know, Jukai refers to the ceremony whereby people sort of formally, the word we use is receive the precepts, is kind of a formal commitment to living a Buddhist life and to a life of practice. And we can spell those out, you know, what those precepts are. But Dogen quotes a guy named, Chinese guy, in the Japanese pronunciation, his name is Choro Sosaku, I don't know what it is in Chinese, right up at the front of the fascicle, a piece called Pure Criteria for Zen Monasteries. And he speaks of those who do not receive the precepts as, and he's referring to people who are, I think, in Zen institutions, or, you know, they're obviously people who've got some connection, but those who do not receive the precepts as, quote, fraternizing without reason in the lineage of emptiness. You know, so it's kind of the opposite thing of what the opposite problem that the Theravadan guys are talking about, where, you know, there's a tendency for the Zen people to maybe get a little bit wrapped up in the meditation side of things and set aside forefront the precepts. So so I think that's all really informative. Zazen thought of in some sort of narrow way, maybe not a good word, but in a narrow way, Dogen talks about it as taking the backward step. And if Zazen is taking back the backward step, Shila, conduct, is how we're encouraged to actually move about in the world, right? So it's sort of the complement. We could even say that ethical conduct or ethical discipline describes how a bodhisattva practices Zazen when they're not on the cushion. And just as well, we could say that Zazen is how bodhisattvas practice precepts when they are on the cushion, right? I mean, I really think there's a sense in which we can do that. And you can correct me if I'm wrong about this stuff later, because I'm kind of like, kind of making it up in some ways.
It's all good.
Even so, we can talk about them separately. But so that's non-separation of Zazen and ethical conduct. But the real point here is not so much that, but what both Shila, I'm going to try and say, and Samadhi are about, which is non-separation of the self and the world and how we understand that and what we do with that. And because we can sort of make that analytical distinction that I made before, noting that, I would like to talk about Shila sort of independently, as if it were different than Zazen. I think most of you probably know the image of Indra's net. The image is of a net that extends sort of infinitely in all directions, you know, sort of a mesh. And at each intersection of the mesh, where the strings or whatever come together, there's a jewel. These jewels are dharmas, all dharmas, which is to say that these jewels include us. And the quality of these jewels is to reflect all the others infinitely. Each jewel is really there, you know, it's really an independent thing in a sense. I'll stay away from the word independent. It really is there. It's really a thing. And the net itself has no being sort of separate from those things. But at the same time, no jewel actually has any truly separate being either. They, you know, they're nothing, they, we, are nothing else but how the entirety of the net appears at a particular time and a particular place. So we, you know, we could call this Dharma position. So we depend on the net depends on us, and the question becomes, well, how do we reflect the world, how, the universe, if you will, the entirety of all dharmas? How do we greet all beings in this particular time and place and welcome them, you know, from our particular Dharma position, our particular situation? How do we actually come to recognize our place in the net, right? Ourselves in our particularity, and at the same time greet the world, meet the world, step forward and interact with the world. This is what I think Shila is about. And there's a whole other discussion that we can have about intention and karma and all those things, but in fact, I'll just sort of let that go for the time being and saying, it actually matters what we do. You know, even though there's an infinity of jewels, of dharmas, it matters what we do, which is to say that Shila, our conduct, how we interact with the world, is important, not only to us, but to the entirety of all beings. So, just kind of a note here, you know, I'm using the term Shila. In our own tradition, we more often talk about the precepts, but I'm trying to stay with the term Shila because it really sort of encompasses this aspect of thing, which finds expression in all traditions of Buddhism, so far as I know. From the earliest time, the Noble Eightfold Path, they talk about the aspects of noble or right speech, noble action, noble livelihood. These have to do with how we interact with each other and other things. We talk, of course, about the Bodhisattva precepts, and then in the Theravadan tradition, you know, for example, they talk about Vinaya, the you know, the sort of very elaborated and specific rules for monks and nuns. These formulations are different, but I think they're all intended to be all-inclusive, to apply to everything. They apply to the entire range of our activities. And typically we think of ethics, you know, this term Shila gets translated as ethical conduct, ethical discipline, as what we do with other people. And to a degree this is appropriate, since this is sort of the most immediate realm that our particular style of beings, i.e. human beings, it's where we live, it's what we inhabit. They're the most obvious jewels in our sort of immediate vicinity in the net. But they're only the most obvious. And I think that Shila, ethical conduct, is intended also to inform our exchanges not only with other people, but also with all sentient beings. And to use the image of the net again, even further, with all dharmas, sentient, insentient. I think as people who have committed to Bodhisattva practice, nothing at all is left outside the boundaries of what we should consider our ethical concern. We should handle stones and zafus according to the precepts as well as we handle, try to handle, aspire to handle people according to the precepts. That's part of why we speak about this as Shila Paramita, perfect or, you know, maybe better, complete Shila. So in a sense, the term ethical is maybe too narrow. We might just as well, maybe more appropriately, speak of appropriate conduct, appropriate discipline, or to adopt the language of the Eightfold Path, noble or right conduct and discipline. I'd like to look at the words discipline and conduct for just a second, and also at the word jukai, because I think it's really interesting. There's this mesh of overlapping meanings that I think are really informative. So jukai, the first character, means to receive or accept, bear. And the kai has kind of two ranges of meanings, one which means warn or caution, admonish, the other which means abstain, refrain. give up. And I get these from a standard Chinese dictionary, not from, you know, more, I'm sure it's got much more refined Buddhist senses as well, but just the words themselves have that kind of semantic range. And this is a really, I think this is a case where the translation into an English word is really felicitous. I looked up discipline and the sort of source of that in Indo-European and the sort of range of semantic echoes that turn up in other words. And, you know, there's nothing rigorous about this, but I think it's always really suggestive because, you know, our words come kind of loaded with these, with, you know, thousands of years of history and sedimented meaning and association. So I always like to look into that. So in looking up discipline, the root is dek. And the root meaning of dek, sort of interestingly, turns out to be to accept, just for, like the Ju in Jukai. But it also has these other cognate words that derive from it, decent, sense of being fitting, decorate, which the dictionary sort of goes on to sort of elaborate as, you know, imbuing with grace, seemliness, elegance, and beauty. And then in a suffix form, dekno, we get dignity, to be worthy, deserving, fitting. And I think all these sort of things like really resonate sort of perfectly, wonderfully with what's being conveyed in the term jukai, or what we talk about when, or shila, sort of what the real intent of that, you know, quote, discipline, that conduct is. You know, so we can think of practicing shila as, you know, in a very general sense, as acting decently, fittingly, with dignity, further, acting with grace, seemliness, elegance, and beauty. The word discipline itself, of course, is a noun, and it means training expected to produce a specific character or pattern of behavior, or training that corrects, molds, or perfects the mental faculties or moral character. And I'll touch on both of these things again in a moment. It's just good to note that. As a verb, it gets a little heavier. It means to punish. And more about this in a minute, too, because I think this is an interesting feature of the word. Okay, so conduct, ethical conduct. What does conduct mean? Well, first we have this interesting, what do you call it, prefix, con. You know, so we're talking about what we do together is, it's automatically, you know, we talk about my conduct to your conduct, you know, right in the word is this sense of like, it's what's happening with us sort of in interaction with each other, right? It's not mine or yours. And then the second part, the duct. Okay, so conduct, the way a person acts, especially from the standpoint of morality or ethics, to use a dictionary definition. Then as a verb, to serve as a medium for conveying or transmitting. And again, this is very resonant in our tradition. And then the second part, I don't know how it's said, D-E-U-K, duk, is the Indo-European root. Sort of words that come from that are conduct, produce, adduce, educate, that deuce kind of thing. It has the sense of drawing out, which, very interestingly, there's a verbal form. So we talked about the rule that monks and nuns undertake in lots of Buddhist traditions is largely associated now with the Theravadan tradition, more so than Zen or the Tibetan tradition, Vinaya. But that has a verbal form, and interestingly, it also has that same kind of semantic range. It means to lead out from, you know, to convey. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm just kind of blown away by how these sort of associated meanings all just kind of flower up together in this really felicitous way. Okay, so at this point I've got all kinds of balls in the air, and now I want to try and draw them together really quickly so we can close this up. Okay, we have this mesh of meanings in the English. The English correlates of Shila that include training, the way a person acts, acting with decency and dignity, conveying, transmitting, and finally, you know, warning, admonition, and punishment. So what does all this have to do with where I started from, which was this idea of Shila as sort of the practice or the practice realization of non-separation? Okay. In Genjo Koan, excuse me, I have to... in Genjo Koan, a very famous line, many of you will know it, there's this beautiful, to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. So, what I want to focus here on this idea of carrying oneself forward and putting that in the context of precepts. So we typically think, you know, here, and not incorrectly, that maybe Dogen is talking mostly about Zazen, but I think he can just as well be understood to be talking about the practice of Shiva, precepts, ethical conduct. The abstaining restraint of Shila, which is expressed in the character Kai or Jukai, is precisely to abstain from carrying oneself forward in a particular way. You know, to lie, to steal, you know, to intoxicate body, mind, yourself, and others, all of those things are, you know, sort of nothing other than carrying forward the self, the small self, and to see oneself, you know, maybe sort of overrate yourself as a jewel that somehow stands apart from the rest of the net. You know, not part of the net, but acting over and against it. You know, thus we experience people and all things as also acting over and against us. We kind of put ourselves in a state of antagonism with the world and our own experience. This actually... You know, to go back to the sense of punishment that's sort of buried in the word discipline, this very thing is its own punishment, right? Because to always and exclusively understand yourself as somehow over and against all the rest of being, I mean, that very idea of separation, and that's what dukkha is. That's what, you know... the problem, you know, that Buddha was seeking to address when he got this whole ball rolling, right? On the other hand, you know, to allow myriad things, all beings, to come forth and experience themselves, and to experience oneself as part of that, you know, that's kind of the end of this punishing mistake, this misperception. So, it's not as though through Zazen and precepts we do away with the delusion of self, but that we give up, in a sense, or see through, we give up being deluded by the delusion of self, you know, and we sort of learn how to greet things properly, seemingly, with dignity and grace, you know, and thus, you know, if you've witnessed it, you can say, oh, those people have learned how to live quite beautifully. You know, finally, we spoke of ethical conduct as, you know, quote, training, training expected, ethical discipline, not conduct, training expected to produce a specific character or pattern of behavior, training that corrects, molds, or perfects the mental faculties or moral character. Well, you know, we do this. We work individually as people to sort of polish this little jewel of our quote-unquote self. And that's okay, you know. Just like we come in and we actually you know, do come in and sit down on our meditation cushions with the idea that, you know, we're going to get somewhere. But we should keep in mind that when we do this, we are in fact being taken in by the delusion of self, you know. And if we cease being deluded by the delusion of self, in other words, we see through the delusion of self, even though the delusion continues, it may turn out that, like Zazen, we practice the precepts not to become Buddhists, but simply because that's what Buddhas do. This idea could be very liberating. So, at the start of all this, I quoted Dogen Fukan Zengi. In closing, I want to misquote it in an effort to sort of characterize this idea of Shila as a paramita. So the Shila I speak of is not being good. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the koan realized. Traps and snares can never reach it. If you grasp this point, you are like a dragon gaining the water, like a tiger taking to the mountains. And I think that's what Shila is about, letting us become a dragon, letting us become a tiger, and live freely and beautifully in the world. So that's it.
Thank you very much, Nyesan. Very interesting, very informative. Questions, comments for Nyesan, please.
Yeah. So this probably isn't going to come out very comparably, but I wanted to ask about this idea of putting yourself forward?
Carrying oneself forward is the term Dogen uses.
So if you let the myriad beings come forth and experience themselves, how is that different than simply living passively? Because it seems to me that there are some times when you have to kind of, I don't know if the correct way to describe it is to carry yourself forward, but there are some times when you have to act in the world in a more assertive way.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's an absolutely essential question, and I don't know that I can answer it well. Maybe Taigen can say something, but I mean, part of it is to realize that you know, that we ourselves as one of the 10,000 things in Dogen's terms, you know, have every right to be here. To sort of like let the world, you know, completely impose on you in terms of, you know, adopting that kind of passive stance, that in a way just sort of reinscribes this idea of separation. So we have a right, and in fact the responsibility to act intentionally in the world. In Zen terms, we talk about doing that for all beings, but always keeping in mind that we are in fact one of those all beings, right? So, I mean, that's not a very adequate answer, but it's like I think when Dogen talks about carrying oneself forward, it has to do with the sense of not like sort of meeting with the world and acting and responding with it in sort of a responsible, intentional, precept-guided way, but actually, we see it all around us, sort of imposing on the world, trying to insist that the world meet us, not only meet us, but meet us on our terms, which puts us in this like relationship of antagonism. So that's part of the answer, but maybe talking to that.
Well, just to add to what Nyesan said, yeah, it's an important question. So the side of delusion, carrying ourselves forward to experience myriad things, as Nyesan said, is imposing or projecting our sense of things on reality, on other beings. The other side, which Dogen calls awakening, is that myriad things, everything comes forth and experiences itself. But that's not something that happens somewhere else on some movie screen or someplace. We are, as Nyesan said, we are part of the, we are the myriad things. So the idea of Indra's net, where we're all connected and each place on the net reflects everything else, we do have a response. When we say that everything comes forth and experiences itself, that's not somewhere outside us. We are expressing that, so we're responsible for that. But it's not that we're imposing our ideas of it on to the myriad things. It's kind of subtle, but it's an important thing to consider. Thank you.
I appreciate this conversation today because it helps me get a better understanding of the concept of the net of jewels. And one way I was thinking about it as we were listening to this discussion was I kind of what you were saying, there's, as a bodhisattva, you have a certain responsibility to, if you're part of this net of jewels, and how you behave ethically or non-ethically is reflected back throughout this entire net of people and non-sentient beings and sentient beings, and it seems like you have a certain responsibility to bring as much ethical behavior to it as possible, because ultimately it's going to come back and affect you and everybody else around you. So like that concept is very kind of easy to grasp.
I know, it's like that image of Indra's net is like so simple in some ways, and it's so endless as you try to like parse out the ramifications of what's contained in that image. But definitely, I mean, that's part of what's there, I think, in this discussion, is that the consequences of our behavior extend in all directions. Hey, Roy.
I just wanted to express my gratitude. This is really very much resonating with me and a lot of things that are going on in my life right now. And I think of, and thinking of Sheila as being connected with Indra's net, with our interconnection among each other, is really helpful. I guess I'm thinking of it as like dancing. And when you're dancing, if one of the partners says, "Hey, look at me," and it becomes a competition with the person that they're dancing with, that's going to be a very ugly couple. You know, it's only when they're each making, you know, each seeing each other, not even trying to make each other look better, seeing each other as connected in that very intimate way, where every move, every gesture is responded to. Each movement is an invitation and a response. Is a different way of looking at it. And the more that I think, okay, I need to do the right thing, is often when I get the most screwed up and I'm doing the exact wrong thing. But when I can see it as what works, what makes this flow right, and not just with two people, but with the entire net of, you know, the net of my company, the net of my family, the net of this sangha, the net of the universe, how can I help this to flow in a way that's elegant, graceful, and peaceful? That, to me, is a completely different way of looking at ethics, and it's just so much more helpful to me.
Yeah, thanks. That's a really good point.
Agnes? And you're so much gentle, too, because you've been true to yourself. I think the part that you mentioned about that sometimes we're confused about we have to be good, you know? And then it gives love to be true to who you are. Mm-hmm. And that's what disconnects us. So thank you for that. Because it's creating that, you know, harmony by being true to yourself rather than trying to be good.
Yeah, being true to yourself and letting other people and things be true to themselves as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Morning.
Good morning. Reaction to your comments and to Roy's. You know, I had an image of, you know, I'm seeing this on the computer, but also just, you know, like downtown, sometimes when there's lots of people, sometimes there's a sense that you can walk down the street and there's a flow, and people are coming both ways, but it's moving. There's a sense of people being aware of each other and moving around and giving enough space. There are other times, maybe when somebody's on a cell phone or oblivious or whatever, that it's like jagged and people are getting, it's like irritated and it's like, hey, watch out, you almost knocked me over. You know, it's like that sort of stuff is happening. And it really does seem to be a difference between an awareness of the interconnection, you know, that we all have to do this dance together or completely in our own world.
Yeah.